Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241. And it's Tuesday. Feels like a Monday, but it's really Tuesday, the 18th. And we're looking at the schedule on the right-hand side. And it looks like we have a lecture exam 1 week from today. 1 week from today. And it's going to cover 1, 2, 3, and 6. Those are the chapters on that first exam. So let's go over what we need for that first exam. You need a Scantron that's nice and clean, a pencil, and an eraser that works really, really well. All right, so double check before you take that exam that eraser works with the exact same pencil that you're going to use. You also need a calculator, a basic non-graphene scientific calculator. Make sure it has batteries. It's probably too dark in here if you have a solar-powered battery. I don't know, maybe it will work, but you should check it out. Okay, you can't use a smartphone as a calculator because there's just too much other stuff that you can put in a smartphone, right? So it's got to be a standalone. And you can't share calculators or pencils or erasers or Scantrons during the test, right? Okay, and the test is going to be different than an online quiz because it's individual effort. Right, closed book, closed notes. Anybody have a question on the test? All right, you guys. You guys in the back. Okay, no questions. Oh, picture ID. You need a picture ID. Somebody asked me if a Fullerton College picture ID will suffice. And believe it or not, it will. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, it's in the syllabus. And, of course, a Fullerton College picture ID is perfect for that. And you'll show me your picture ID when you turn your test in. Okay, so any questions over the material we covered last week? We talked about different kinds of receptors. Some are in the plasma membrane, some are cytoplasmic. Okay, and a receptor is going to bind a ligand. A ligand is a smaller molecule that fits into something that looks like the active site on a receptor. And receptors that are in the cytoplasm will bind lipophilic compounds, right, or hydrophobic compounds. Does anybody know why cytoplasmic receptors will bind hydrophobic signaling compounds? Why is that? Why is that possible? Like an example would be a steroid hormone. Yeah, because they can actually diffuse right through the cell membrane, right? Because that inner compartment of the cell membrane are those fatty acids all lined up, and so lipid materials can move through the cell membrane, but hydrophilic compounds won't because that lipid layer is going to exclude them from being transported across the cell, unless there are some proteins in the membrane as well. Okay. So that's what we talked about last time. So now we're going to get into Chapter 3, Cell Structure and Genetic Control. This is going to be our last chapter for the test. All right, here we are. Oh, I got two nice projectors today. Oh, I also did build the website where you can find lectures. All right, so you can, and the link is in Blackboard as well. Somebody had a question about the online study questions, because I have a couple editions of questions that you can that are linked to your Blackboard page. And one student noticed that in different editions of the textbook, the question might be the same, but the answers are different. Right? And they would like to know which one they should know. And what I would like for you to know is to really analyze that question and see if the questions are really the same, right? And analyze those answers. And maybe you should come up with a good answer yourself. Okay, maybe it's a combination of the two from different editions. All right, so I don't think it's anything you can memorize, but it's just something that you have to figure out, either by changing the question around or changing some of the answers around. Yeah. No, I didn't get any emails from anybody. I just wanted to count how many students needed them so that I would have them on hand. But the access code is huge. I couldn't even type it in accurately. And you probably can't type it in accurately either. So I want to send it to you electronically. So send me an email. I'd be happy to zip that out to you really soon. Because I'm just going to copy it from my email and email it to you. Anything in the study guide, and some of those other editions, like maybe the 10th and 11th edition, do have some good questions that are online that you can practice. And some of those questions might be similar to what's in the 12th edition. Some of them are different. And it's the ones that I like from each of those editions. And they could end up on the exam. That's why I have them on the study guide.
Okay.
Yeah. So practice those over and over and over again. And if you really have your mind set up to memorize the answers to those questions, that probably won't work really well for you because there's just too many to memorize. You have to develop a feel, a sense of what they're talking about. And then you'll be able to answer those questions a lot more easily. Okay. And don't forget the exam figures, too. And there's some quantitative questions in the back. Quantitative questions. Okay, one last thing I do want to go over that we talked about last time, and that is co-transport. And I think your book makes it a little bit confusing, but I like to break co-transport down into two subclassifications. All right, and in terms of co-transport, what could these two different ways be? Yeah, so it could be symport or it could be antiport. These are examples of co-transport. Symport means that both molecules are going in the same direction across the membrane. Antiport means that two compounds are moving in opposite directions. Nonetheless, the gradient in one of those molecules across the membrane is the energy source for transporting the other one. And that gradient is established by primary active transport. But co-transport or symport, antiport is what we call secondary active transport. Right? ATP is not used up directly, only indirectly when it makes the gradient. Okay, so that was an important point. All right, so let's move on to next chapter. Oh, here's a sign-in sheet. Please sign that, pass it around. Okay, so we're going to be talking about cells today. All right, got it back. All right, so here's a cell. All right, and this is the building block of life. It's the structural and functional unit of life. And if you know how this thing here works, all the pieces of this object right here, you pretty much have a really good idea of what life is all about. All right, so that's why we're interested in the cell. Okay, so in order to be a cell, it has to have a membrane that separates the inside living world with the outside world. We call that a plasma membrane because it's very fluid, right? It moves around very easily, right? So it's got to have a plasma membrane. It's got to have cytoplasm. This is where the living biochemical reactions are taking place, right? So it just can't be a crystal of some kind. Right, there actually has to be a watery, jelly-like material that supports different kinds of biochemical reactions. And it also has to have genetic material. And in our cells, that genetic material is contained within the nucleus. The nucleus has a membrane around it, and that protects the genetic material for us. All right, so if it has all three of those, then it's a cell. Okay, and it has to have all three in one form or another. Genetic material doesn't have to be in a nucleus. The cell just has to have genetic material someplace available for it. Okay, so we can break down the cell into the plasma membrane and cytoplasm. And this slide is a little bit of a misnomer because a more modern conception of cytoplasm is the fluid part inside the cell, which is what we call cytosol. All kinds of enzymes and substances are dissolved in that cytosol, and organelles as well. So cytosol and organelles make up cytoplasm. So organelles is a subset of cytoplasm. Okay. So we're going to look at various organelles inside the cell. And of course, this is not an anatomy class. So what do we really want to know about all of these organelles? Yeah, what their function is. And of course, I want you to come up with their function by their shape, right? So I'm sure this is an exam figure, right? But just don't tell me the name of these things. I do want to know what the function is. All right, so The cell membrane is super special. There are two different ways you can think about it. You can think about it as the phospholipid bilayer. That's a nice simple understanding of what a cell membrane is. And can you see this bilayer on the slide right here? Right here is the layer that's facing the extracellular environment. Here is the exact same layer, right, of that basic building block that's facing inside the cell. And you probably recognize this thing that has a head group and then two tails. That's a phospholipid. Yeah, and we actually built a membrane on the blackboard one time, right? But it was just a single layer. The cell membrane is a double layer. And of course, the fatty acids in the deep layer and the fatty acids in the superficial layer attract each other and form that nice lipid barrier that keeps hydrophilic compounds from moving across the membrane by diffusion. Right, so the phospholipid bilayer is not very strong. It just wiggles around all over the place. And so probably even a better way to think of a cell membrane or plasma membrane, same thing, is the fluid mosaic model. So that phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. If we were to put this on the surface of some water in a glass and jiggle that glass of water, it would undulate right on the surface of the water. It wouldn't fracture, it wouldn't bend or anything like that. Right, it would wiggle right along with the water. All right, so that's the fluid part. The mosaic part is that in a living membrane, it has all kinds of other things embedded in it. Here are some cholesterol molecules. These are lipids, and so they're happy to be within this lipid layer. Cholesterol has the ability to stabilize the membrane, to make it less fluid. Right, so it imparts some rigidity to the membrane. Then we also have proteins that can dissolve in the plasma membrane. And here I have a protein that moves all the way across from inside to outside the cell. Other proteins you might just see inside the cell. They don't go all the way across the membrane. And some are long and filamentous. Some have glucose molecules joined to them. And so they're not just strictly a protein, but they're a glycoprotein. A glycoprotein is one that's a protein, and it also has some sugar molecules attached to it. Right, and other kinds of modifications to lipids that are in the membrane by adding sugars to them. So here would be an example of a glycolipid. Right, glyco just refers to sugar or probably glucose. All right, so these different proteins, we see they poke down into the intracellular side. These things can be attached to microtubules inside the cell. Microtubules then can push and pull on the membrane and determine the shape of the cell by pushing on the membrane. Or maybe there are even some shapeshifter cells in your body. They just crawl around by diapedesis. Does anybody know what kind of cells actually crawl around in your body? Because they're shapeshifters. They can change their shape. They can squeeze out in one direction, squeeze over here. Like white blood cells. Yeah, macrophage would be a really good example of that. Okay, and they're constantly moving around looking for foreign substances that are in your body. Okay, so other kinds of proteins that we have could be channels. So here's one that goes all the way across the membrane. And, you know, if I use my imagination, I can think maybe there's a channel going through this one, and that channel can open and close to allow hydrophilic compounds to move across the membrane. There could be transporters, active transporters that move molecules across. Like what kind of active transporter have you learned about? That most of the energy that you eat goes just to keep that thing working in your body. I hear it. It's a sodium potassium ATP pump. Yep, because all your cells have many, many of those, and of course you have trillions of cells in your body that require that ATP. Some of these other proteins can be receptors, right? Other proteins can be enzymes, and that's going to be the focus of the next chapter. An enzyme speeds the rate of a chemical reaction up so that it happens very quickly. Right? Some chemical reactions would happen inside our body, but it might take 1,000 years. And, of course, that wouldn't help us out. With an enzyme, one of the things that it does, it speeds it up so that it happens many, many, many times in just 1 second. Okay, so we've got receptors, we've got enzymes, we've got structural features. And so a lot of different things can be added to the plasma membrane. So the best way to think of a plasma membrane is the fluid mosaic model. One last thing. See the branching pattern on these sugar molecules? Okay, this branching pattern acts like an address for this particular organism. All the cells in this organism's body, for instance, like a human body, will have sugar molecules with this kind of conformation or configuration or shape. Right? And so how your immune system knows that a cell belongs to you is that it has this particular cell surface marker on it. Right? Then we call that an antigen. Antigens are on the surface of the plasma membrane poking up into the extracellular environment. And your brothers and sisters would have antigens pretty similar to the same shape, but maybe not exactly, but very, very similar. Okay, your cousins, there would be even more disparity between the shape of these antigens and yours. And if you go to somebody that's not related to you, then the shape of these antigens is going to be quite different. So your immune system would be able to tell that these cells don't belong to your body. And of course, if there's other kinds of cells in there, like bacteria, then the antigens are going to be way totally different, and your immune system will be able to recognize those things as foreign invaders. All right, so antigens, enzymes, transporters, pumps, structural features. Okay, these are all things that identity markers, that's an antigen. You can cross identity marker out and put an antigen right there. These are all things that can be placed within the plasma membrane. And the apical surface of a cell membrane, if it's an epithelium, could even be different than the basal surface. It can have different components put in it. Okay, some might have pumps, some might have facilitated diffusion proteins. It all depends on the type of tissue it is. Okay, so we talked about antigens. Okay, so the cell membrane on some cells, all right, can change shape pretty drastically. And this might be an example of a monocyte, and it runs into this particle right here, and I can see some antigens on the surface of this little particle. This could be a bacteria. It's recognized as being foreign to this cell, and because there are microtubules inside the cell attaching to the membrane, it can push and pull the membrane, so the cell will flow around and completely engulf this particle and end up as a vesicle inside the cell. When that happens, we call that phagocytosis. Right, oh, here, macrophage. Really good example of a macrophage. So phagocytosis is just a form of endocytosis. And that means bringing material into the cell. The other kind of endocytosis is what we call pinocytosis. That's a nonspecific uptake, and sometimes we think of it as a solution. So there are compounds that the cell is taking up, and we can think of that as like cell drinking. Pino means drinking. Phago is eating. Pino means drinking. And of course, these are active transport mechanisms. They require ATP in order for these things to work. Okay, the opposite is exocytosis. When something is in a vesicle and then that vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, fuses to the plasma membrane, and whatever inside that vesicle then gets released through the extracellular environment. Right, again, that's bulk transport, and that happens via secretory vesicles. Right, so any of these vesicles are organelles that we call membrane-bound. A membrane-bound organelle is just an organelle that has some kind of membrane surrounding it. Like we saw, the nucleus has a membrane. Mitochondria has membrane. Golgi, endoplasmic reticulum are made from membranes. And so we call those, all of those are membrane-bound organelles. Some cells have a special utility made out of microtubules. Right? And some of these things change the shape of the surface of a cell. Right? And I've got three types of organelles here that are associated with the plasma membrane. Cilia. Right? Cilia is relatively short. It has microtubules, so these cilia can bend and sweep. And they will sweep fluid over the surface of an epithelium. Right? Unicellular organisms use cilia to actually swim around in their environment, but we don't have any cells that can swim around using cilia. All of our ciliated cells are in a membrane, Okay, then the membrane doesn't move, but the material on top of that membrane can be swept one way or the other. Some good examples of that sweeping motion would be the epithelium that lines the trachea. Because when we breathe in dust particles, it gets trapped in mucus of our respiratory passageways, and then the cilia sweeps that garbage up into our mouth to get it out of our body so it doesn't go down into our lungs. And so when all that stuff is in your mouth, then what do you do with it? You just swallow it down, okay? And that prevents it from getting in the lungs. Okay, so some places have cilia in the female reproductive tract because an oocyte or an egg doesn't have the ability to swim, right? It doesn't have cilia and it doesn't have flagella, so it's just a cell that is floating in a suspension, and the fallopian tubes are ciliated, they have ciliated cells, and they're sweeping toward the uterus. So whenever an egg is ovulated, the best case scenario is that it's trapped in that fluid motion through the fallopian tube to the uterus as a result of those cilia. Okay. There's one cell in the human body that has something that's similar to a cilia. It's made out of microtubules, but it's much longer, and that's called a flagellum. Flagellum is just singular, and probably everybody knows that a male gamete has a flagellum. Sometimes we call that a sperm cell, and it can swim around anywhere in a watery environment, right, as long as the pH is proper. Microvilli almost look like cilia, but they're much shorter, right? They have microtubules inside of them to give them that shape, but they don't move around. They're just stationary, and they're on the surface of a cell to increase the surface area of that membrane. And I think we looked at surface area one time before with regard to a concept. What concept was that? And whenever I say surface area, okay, I want you to think of an everyday object that you use all the time. Yeah, doorway, right? Surface area, doorway. As the cell has more and more microvilli, the surface area gets bigger, the doorway gets bigger, and absorption increases as a result, or maybe any other kind of membrane transport process increases as the cell surface area increases. Okay, so here I can see some cilia. You can see the microtubules inside the cilia. And if you were to think of anything that a microtubule does, is that it's responsible for moving things around inside the cell, or moving cilia, or moving a flagella, or pushing and pulling on the plasma membrane to change the shape of the cell. So they're always going to be involved with motion of some kind. Okay. All right, so microvilli. So for the function of these organelles, probably if you just think of an organelle and have a one-word bullet point, right, to describe what's happening, that would be really nice so that it can crystallize in your mind. So for a cilia, what would be a good function for cilia? I would just say motility. Motility. And what about a flagellum? I would say motility once again. Okay. And microvilli, the function is absorption. Yeah, so you're getting a pretty clear picture with that. Okay, let's talk about some other kinds of organelles. Oh, here's a slide that clearly defines what cytoplasm is, right? So cytoplasm has two components. It's the fluid part and organelles that are inside the cell. That's a modern understanding of what cytoplasm is. Okay, here's the cytoskeleton inside of a cell. I see one cell over here, nice nucleus inside all of them. And let's look at the illustration, because now I see that cytoskeleton along with some other organelles, like mitochondria. Right? And I don't see a vesicle. I wish I saw a vesicle. But this lattice of microtubules acts like a railway system inside the cell. Things can hop a ride on a microtubule to move from one part of the cell to another. Right? So if there is a vesicle over here, it can attach to a microtubule and end up over here, or maybe move from rough endoplasmic reticulum to a Golgi body or Golgi apparatus. Or maybe there is a secretory vesicle here that gets moved over to the plasma membrane for secretion. The way that those things move are on these things that kind of look to me like monorails inside of the cell. Okay, so microtubules are important for another form of motility, okay, because it can move organelles, it can even move chromosomes around, as we're going to see in a little bit. Okay, so here is a really good exam figure for you. All right, so let's talk about some of these things. All right, so here is the plasma membrane, right? It separates the living world from the non-living world outside the cell. And here is the nucleus. It's a double membrane-bound organelle. Inside the nucleus is genetic material, and we could call that DNA. And that is the blueprint on how to build this particular cell. And if it's the blueprint on how to build the cell, okay, what else is it controlling? It's just not how to build the cell, but how the cell functions, right? Because function is determined by the structure. So even though this information determines structure, right, secondhand, it also determines what the function of the cell is as well. Right, there might be a dark area right here, the nucleolus. That's an very active part of the nucleus. And it's responsible for making RNA. We're going to talk about RNA in just a little bit. All right, so the nucleus, I think the term I would like you to know is protection. All right, what is it protecting? Yeah, it's protecting this all this genetic material, this heredity material, because if that information was lost or damaged, then the cell would die as a result of that. Right? So all of that information has to be protected, and it is protected nicely by the nuclear membrane. Okay, I see some other membrane organelles inside the cell. Here's a bean-shaped organelle. It's got an inner membrane with folds in it. Does anybody know what those inner folds are called? I don't know if you read ahead. I think I heard it. Christi, yeah, these are the Christi membrane. The inner mitochondrial membrane is a Christi membrane, and this one we just call the outer mitochondrial membrane. All right, and there are living biochemical reactions that are happening inside the cell, and here's something pretty strange. This mitochondria even has genetic material all by itself. So what did we call a cell? What are the three things that a cell has to have? Plasma membrane. Does the mitochondria have a membrane? Indeed it does. Okay, plasma membrane is one. Cytoplasm is another, all right? And mitochondria have cytoplasm. There are biochemical reactions. And genetic material. Does the mitochondria have genetic material? Yes, it's extranuclear, all right? And that genetic material is a set of instructions on how to build a mitochondria, not a human cell. All right, so there is an endosymbion theory. Oh, what does that mean, if it's a theory? That people that are educated and study this topic all agree, okay, that this thing really looks like a bacteria, and sometime in our ancient history, we had a cell that had a nucleus and all these organelles, but did not have mitochondria. That cell was infected by mitochondria, and they then realized that they could live together very harmoniously. And we call that a symbiosis. And so this cell gets something out of this mitochondria living inside of it, and the mitochondria also gets something from living inside the cell. So we should actually consider what those two things are. Okay, what does the cell get out of this mitochondria that's inside of it? ATP, that's right. That's the primary function of this mitochondria. And what does mitochondria get out of the deal? How come it just doesn't run out on its own? It can make plenty of ATP for itself. Why is it staying inside the cell? Yeah, for protection, because there are viruses that attack bacteria. Okay, and also, nutrients that it needs to make ATP are provided to it. Right? We have the respiratory system that helps deliver oxygen, and a circulatory system which helps deliver oxygen and other kinds of nutrients that it needs. Right? So our bodies, or these cells, actually support the processes that are taking place inside the mitochondria. Well, since that time when that cell was infected, now this type of cell, like what we have in our body, can no longer function without mitochondria. And mitochondria can't live by themselves anymore either. So now right? This is just a symbiosis that cannot be reversed. So we'd like to think of this as an organelle, but since it has genetic material, okay, it controls its own replication rate. It divides, okay, just like it controls its own destiny inside the cell. Okay, so that's a very interesting organelle, and it's membrane-bound. I see another membrane-bound organelle, and it kind of curves around the nucleus, and even, right, it's continuous with the membrane of the nucleus, right? And I see these little dots on it, so it doesn't have a smooth surface. It has a surface that kind of looks like sandpaper, so we call this rough endoplasmic reticulum. Right, these little dots right here are ribosomes. Ribosomes are the workbench where proteins are made. And what kind of building blocks does a protein need in order to be built? Yeah, it needs amino acids, right? So these ribosomes, right, can get amino acids and can get instructions from the DNA inside the cell on how to build a protein. Then it has the building blocks and can actually make a protein as a result. Okay, and that protein ends up inside the Christi membrane of, or the cisternae, I'm sorry, the cisternae, this inside area of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so because it has a ribosome, we say the function of rough ER is, it's got to be two words, protein synthesis, right? Protein synthesis. And here I see some ribosomes floating free in the cytosol, okay? And their job is protein synthesis as well. Okay, so the ribosome is just a workbench where proteins are made. They're either floating in the cytoplasm or attached to the plasma membrane. Okay, so the proteins that are made by the free ribosomes end up in the cytoplasm. Proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum have a different fate. They end up inside vesicles. Those vesicles can stay inside the cell, or they could be a part of a secretory pathway where a vesicle moves over to the cell membrane and is exocytosed, right, into the extracellular space. We would call that a secretory vesicle. Proteins made by rough ER, right, their fate is for secretion, or maybe they're going to be inside of a vesicle for their whole useful life. While proteins made by free ribosomes end up where? Yeah, just in the cytosol. They never end up in a vesicle, right? They just are proteins that are needed by the cytoplasm. Okay, here is another kind of endoplasmic reticulum. And do you see any ribosomes on this one right here? No ribosomes. So, could this ER make proteins? No, because we need a ribosome to do that. Right, so this is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. This is important for making lipids and modifying lipids. That's a really good thing. What kind of lipid that you know about that has a special modification on it? Yeah, phospholipid, right? So you could say that this smooth endoplasmic reticulum, one of its jobs is to make phospholipid. And does this cell need a lot of phospholipid? Absolutely, because the plasma membrane is made out of phospholipid as well as all of these other membranes that we see inside the cell. Okay, what are some other... I see some vesicles. It's hard to tell what kind of vesicles these really are. Okay, so I'm just going to enumerate some things that you should be aware of. Right, and so here's a vesicle. Let's call this one a lysosome. And a lysosome has proteins in it that are enzymes. We call them lysozyme. Lysozyme will break down big macromolecules into their building blocks. Right, so the job of a lysosome is digestion. It's an intracellular digestive system. That's one important thing for you to know. Oh, another kind of vesicle might contain other kinds of enzymes that get rid of toxic compounds that can sometimes build up inside the cell. Right, and so peroxidase would be one of those kinds of enzymes, and so that would be a peroxisome. The job of peroxisome is not digestion, but detoxification. That's a pretty important consideration. There's another kind of vesicle that we're going to talk about. I don't really think it's shown on the slide, but you got to write it down on one of your pieces of paper, and that's an endosome, E-N-D-O-S-O-M-E, right? And the job of an endosome is that it's a reservoir for membrane transporters or membrane proteins, right? When those transporters or proteins are in the membrane of an endosome, right, then they're not on the cell surface, and so they can't transport anything across the cell membrane. But with the proper signal, that endosome moves over to the plasma membrane, and then now all those transporters are inserted into the plasma membrane, and material can move back and forth. Right? So it's a reservoir of membrane transporters. So those are three important kinds of vesicles. Ah, I forgot something real important about the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. What did we say so far? Yeah, lipid synthesis, right? That's a good thing. All right, but can anybody remember the slide that had a cell and it had sodium outside, sodium inside the cell, had chlorine inside, chlorine outside, had potassium inside and outside. What else did it have? Which one did I forget? Ah, calcium. Yeah, calcium. And where is calcium at a high concentration in a normal cell that's just at rest? Outside, right? So there's very little, it's almost zero inside the cytoplasm or inside the cytosol. And so the job of endoplasmic reticulum is to take up calcium from low concentration and put it in high concentration inside the smooth ER. What do we call it when a molecule goes from low to high concentration? Low to high. Like think of some water that's underground and you want to bring it up to the surface so you can drink it. Okay, that's active transport. So smooth endoplasmic reticulum has transporters, right, that rely on ATP to move calcium inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so another good thing to say for smooth ER is that it's a reservoir of calcium ions. And since there's no calcium inside the cell, if it ever leaves the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, that can be used as a signaling compound to change the function inside the cell. And I think on maybe one of the last slides in the last lecture, we saw that calcium sometimes is used as a messenger. What kind of messenger? If it's inside the cell. Okay, well, and so we learned about two different kinds of messengers. One that's outside, one that's inside. And remember, they can't go across the membrane. One is the first messenger outside the cell, and the second messenger is always trapped inside the cell. Calcium could be a really good example of a second messenger. And that's going to, when calcium builds up inside the cell, it's going to change the physiology of the cell. Okay. But you know calcium. What do you know calcium is good for? Ooh, you guys know a little physiology already. I heard muscle contraction. Yeah, that's true. All right, I thought I could surprise you. What else? Bones, yeah, bones. In order to have strong bones, you need calcium. You also need phosphate in there as well, but you need calcium, right? You need it for muscle contraction. And so what do you think would be more important for you, to have calcium in muscle so that they contract or calcium in bones so that they're super strong? And sometimes you can't say both. You have to make a choice, okay? Right, as we get older, your body has to make a choice because we run low on calcium. And of course, your decision would be the same as your body, and that is to maintain proper muscle function. And where do muscles get their calcium from? From your bones. And so what happens to your bones then? They get weaker, and that condition is called osteoporosis. Right, osteoporosis. Okay, because you couldn't even breathe without muscle contraction. Your heart couldn't pump. Right, without muscle contraction. So those are even more important than having a good skeleton. All right, so don't forget about calcium and this smooth ER. Here is a Golgi apparatus, Golgi complex. Golgi body has a number of different names. And when a protein is made by rough ER, it ends up inside of a vesicle, hops a ride on a microtubule, right, over to the Golgi apparatus. And the job of the Golgi apparatus is modification, so that it can take a protein and make a glycoprotein out of it, right? Or add some other kinds of compounds to a protein that's going to change its function inside the cell. So it changes a protein into something more complex, could conjugate a lipid onto it, could conjugate a sugar molecule onto it, right? And then, and of course it's trapped inside the Golgi body, right? And then it moves over to the end of the Golgi body and it forms a little bud and breaks away, forms a vesicle, right? And then that vesicle can move over to the plasma membrane and release that material into the extracellular environment. So that's something we call a secretory pathway, right? Starting with material built in the rough ER, moving to the Golgi body, where it is. Give me one good term for Golgi body. Modification, yeah, modification is great. And you could say modification and packaging, because it also packages that modified protein in a vesicle, all right, for secretion. So that's the secretory pathway. Rough ER, Golgi apparatus, secretory vesicle, and then finally that material is outside the cell. Okay, mitochondria right here. Well, we talked about that, right? Its function is to make ATP. Okay, and ATP is that energy currency that most of the processes, like 99.9% of all the processes in your cell need, right? That's the energy source for them. So we bring in energy in the form of food, right? Like an ice cream cone, but all of these organelles can't use an ice cream cone to do their job. That's not a good energy source, right? The mitochondria can change that ice cream cone into ATP with the help of some things, right? And then all these organelles can go about their function. All right, so that's a job of mitochondria. Oh, I wanted to say something else. Oh, well. Okay, so we see a bunch of microtubules inside the cell. Remember, they can push and pull on the membrane. They can attach organelles to them and move the organelles around inside the cell. And I see some here. There's even some smaller ones called microfilaments. I don't know if I see any in this illustration. All right, and these things need a control center. That control center are the centrioles. I see one here and one here. They're usually perpendicular to each other. And in most times of the life cycle of a cell, there's only two of these things. When we put two together perpendicular, we call that a centrosome. A centrosome. Okay, and its job is to organize and control the microtubule system. Right, so it can control that railway system inside the cell. And so then it directs where these organelles might end up as well. Okay, so that's the centrioles. Okay, inside the nucleus, right, we have that genetic material, and genetic material is made out of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, and that DNA is organized into chromosomes. And does anybody know how many chromosomes a human cell has, a normal human cell, not a sex cell, but a normal one? Yeah, 46. We call that a somatic cell. A somatic cell are all the cells inside your body except your sex cells. And your sex cells only have half the number of chromosomes. Could you take a guess? Could you give me the name of a sex cell? Like a sperm. Yeah, sperm has half the number, right? That's a male cell, and the counterpart would be female. That would be egg, right? That has half the number of the chromosomes. So those are not somatic cells. Right? Those are what we call gametes sometimes. Okay? Those are the sex cells. Okay, so the nucleus, right, the nuclear envelope protects that genetic material. And in this particular illustration, if I look around the nucleus, I do not see any chromosomes. I just see kind of a homogeneous color all over the place, maybe a little bit of gradation, but I don't see very much. The nucleolus, okay, is a special area that's very active, so it's darker, but I can't really see any chromosomes in there. So if I were to look at this, the cell at the nucleus right here, I would say that all of that genetic material, or chromatin, is in an extended form. Extended means that it has been unwound, right, and it's a big, huge, long filament inside, actually 46 big, huge, long filaments inside the nucleus. All right, so here is extended chromatin, and chromatin you'll find in a part of the life cycle of the cell called interphase. This is when the cell is doing its normal everyday job. All right, For instance, if it's a muscle, it's contracting. If it's an endocrine cell, then it's producing a hormone and secreting it. Right? If it's a neuron, then it's sending electrical impulses. That happens during interphase. Okay, so that's the job of the nucleus. So make sure you know functions for all of these things. Lysosome, digestive system. And it's really important to know these, because when somebody is having a stroke, for instance, or a heart attack, one of the things that the cells lose is ATP. And when a cell loses ATP, then the organization of the membranes start to disappear. The plasma membrane, membranes around lysosomes start to get leaky when somebody's having a heart attack in their heart or in their brain when they're having a stroke. All right, so what happens when those lysosomes start to break apart when somebody's having a heart attack? Okay, what's the job of a lysosome? In one, digestion, right? So those things, when they break apart, then start to digest things that are in the cytoplasm, things that you don't want them to digest. So one of the therapies that people have figured out, oh, it's been some time now, is to give membrane stabilizers. So when somebody's having a heart attack, of course, we'd like to do other good things, but we would certainly like to stabilize all of those membranes so that the cells don't start digesting themselves. Okay? And steroids would be a good way. And you saw where a steroid is embedded in that membrane. Okay. Peroxisomes, detoxification, mitochondria makes ATP. Right? Make sure you know that endosymbiont theory. And how important is ATP? Let's talk about ATP for just a second. How important is that? How could you think of ATP? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's go back. Lysosome. There are some cell lines that are made to live for only a short period of time or a set period of time. And then they have to be rebuilt. And these lysosomes are programmed to actually destroy some of these cells after their useful lifespan. Okay? And that's really important because there are some cells, atypical pathological cells in your body, that never die. Can anybody think of a really problematic kind of cell that never dies and it just keeps growing? Yeah, like cancer cells. Okay? And so these lysosomes, okay, are really important because it's a nice way to help control cancer from having cells turn into tumors or cancerous tissues. Right? That would be a normal condition. That would be programmed cell death. Right? But of course, we don't want all the normal cells in your body to start leaking digestive enzymes into the cytoplasm because we need most of the cells inside our body. How's that? Pretty good? Yeah, okay. Okay, peroxisomes. ATP, right? Mitochondria. Don't forget about that endosymbiont theory. When it says theory, what does that mean? Yeah, it's been tested, right? So it is reliable information. Okay? That this thing actually was a bacterium at one point in time, and it has its own genetic material. What do you know? What can you do if you have a bacterial infection? Today, what can you do? Take an antibiotic. That's right. Right? If you have maybe a strep throat or something like that, and every once in a while, when somebody takes an antibiotic, it starts to destroy mitochondria as well as bacteria that are not supposed to be in your body. Well, what happens to those cells that need these mitochondria? Well, they start to die as a result of that. So that's another good reason not to abuse what? Antibiotics, because you might be one of those unlucky people, right, where you start to lose mitochondria, and that's really a horrible disease, and nobody knows really how to treat such a thing yet. Okay. Yeah. Enough of the mitochondria get damaged that it can't replicate and rebuild good ones. Okay. So something must have happened to that genetic material inside the mitochondria, right? Yeah, that's too bad. So it's usually progressive. I don't know, it never really reverses as far as I know. That's one thing I wanted to mention. Oh, ATP. How important is ATP? That's what we're talking about. Everybody agrees it's really, really important. And how important is it? Well, if we were to shut off blood supply to the brain, which means that no oxygen is going to the brain, and these mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP, right? What is one important function that your brain is providing for you right now? Most people is providing you with a nice wakeful state, right? You're alert, taking notes, listening, right? When mitochondria don't get oxygen, that ATP starts to disappear and you lose consciousness when that happens. Does anybody have a good feeling for how long it takes for you to lose consciousness when your brain is no longer getting oxygen? We cut off oxygen supply to the brain, when do you become unconscious? Okay, it's seconds, it's 2 to 3 seconds, right? So if somebody has a heart, their heart stops, goes into fibrillation, they have 2 or 3 seconds of consciousness, right? And that's pretty much about it. And, of course, that could be terrible because what happens after you become unconscious? Well, your brain is going to die. Yeah. How long do you have? Okay, 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, but when does a brain die? How? What period of time? Yeah, 2 to 3 minutes, right? So that's why it's really a good idea for a lot of people to know how to use these automatic electronic defibrillators and CPR and stuff like that, because if you're CPR trained, you can actually help beat somebody's heart even when it's not beating on its own, right? And that can deliver enough oxygen to the brain, probably not to make the person conscious again, but at least to keep the brain from dying, right? So that's why they say when you start CPR, you should never do what? You should never stop it, right? Because maybe you don't think you're doing any good, but maybe you're getting enough oxygen to the brain to save that person's life, even though you can't really recognize that. All right, so that's how you should think of ATP one way. Another way is that a typical textbook person weighs 70 kilograms. And 70 kilograms is a little bit more than 150 pounds. That's just a textbook person, right? But let's just think of 70 kilograms. How much ATP does your body need in terms of weight in order for it to function for one day? If you're 70 kilograms, you need 40 kilograms of ATP. So not that you have to carry around a luggage 40 grams of ATP, but as soon as ATP is used up, guess what happens? It gets rebuilt by this mitochondria, right? And you need 40 kilograms of that molecule being built by mitochondria every single day. So that's what? That's more than half your body weight in ATP. Right? I find that astounding. Okay, here is an organelle that is not membrane bound. This is a ribosome, and you know something about ribosomes. What's a good thing for ribosome that you should know? Protein synthesis, yeah. Well, at least one step in protein synthesis. These are very, very small. This is a computer-generated model, and maybe you can see that there are actually two subunits. There's one over here, and there's one over here. They fit together very nicely, and when they fit together, guess what you have? You have a passageway through the ribosome, and there's some important enzymatic processes that happen with another kind of RNA as it moves through, okay, this special little tunnel. This is actually where proteins are made, right, mostly inside this little tunnel right there. Okay, so smoothie R. So what some functions of smoothie are? Lipid synthesis, calcium storage, calcium reservoir. What about rough ER? Protein synthesis. Here is a really nice example of a secretory pathway where proteins are made inside a rough ER, and then they move by vesicular transport to a Golgi apparatus. And when they're in a Golgi apparatus, what happens to them? They're modified somehow, maybe cut in half, something's added to them, and then they're placed in another membrane sac, vesicle, and that vesicle could stay inside the cell and become a lysosome, for instance, or it could move over to the cell membrane, and that material then is secreted outside the cell. So proteins made by free ribosomes and ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum have different fates, and you should be aware of that. Okay, nucleus. Contains the cell's DNA, the nuclear envelope. Small molecules can move across these pores. Larger molecules have to be moved across by active transport. Okay. All right. Gene expression. Where do we have genes? Okay. And you have genes that make up chromosomes inside the nucleus, right? And a gene is a certain length of DNA on a chromosome that can tell the cell how to build a certain kind of protein. And what are proteins made out of again? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid, right? And there are about 20 different kinds of amino acids. You could think of different amino acids as being different letters in an alphabet, okay? And that RNA that leaves, okay, comes from DNA. That DNA knows how to spell all those different proteins out. It knows the correct spelling. It knows what amino acids have to be placed next to each other in order to build a particular protein, right? And if the order of letters in a word changes, what does that mean? If you rearrange letters in a word, then the meaning totally changes, right? If you rearrange the sequence of amino acids in a protein, then you change the function of that particular protein, and it might not be functional at all, right? And that information is contained within inside the nucleus here. And so it's got to be protected behind the nuclear membrane. Well, that seems kind of a little bit complicated for all these organelles inside the cell. And, right? So why does a nice advanced cell like we have, why does it have all of these organelles? Well, some things like bacteria can live just fine without them. Why do we have all these organelles? Because you saw that they all have different functions, right? So you could say they're specialized to do a particular job. And that's pretty good. Okay, but I have maybe a better way to think about it. I'm trying to talk somebody into this. We're going to remodel this building sometime really soon. And my conception is just to break down all of the walls that we have in this building and make one big, huge room and full of chairs and have maybe 5 or 10 instructors in the building, and I'll give a physiology lecture, physics lecture will be going on, chemistry lecture will be going on at the same time in the same room, math, right, will be going on, geology at the same time, and I think that's a really good idea because you could graduate in just one semester. Wouldn't that be fantastic? I see some people shaking their heads no. Why? Well, explain to me, why is that not fantastic? I almost sold this idea to somebody. Why is that not fantastic? Because when somebody's given a physiology lecture, that would interfere with the chemistry lecture. When somebody's given a chemistry lecture, that would interfere with the physiology and the math, et cetera, right? So the reason why our cells have these organelles is so that they can do their job without interference, right? Without hurting the job of other things that have to happen inside the cell at the same time, okay? So all of these organelles you should think of maybe as rooms in a building that have specific functions, and those rooms are just special partitions so that these different processes or different classes don't interfere with each other. All right, so that's why it's pretty important to know some of these different functions. Okay, so a gene we find in DNA, and that's the information on how to build a protein, so it knows what amino acids should be put next to each other in a protein. And so it contains information. So I want to give you now the central dogma of biology. It has to do with information flow, right? And maybe you could look up dogma sometimes, but it is just, it's not really a theory, it's just a statement that you should not question, okay? Now, how does that work with science? Should you question anything in science? Or should we just live our lives by dogma? You should question everything, right, when you're in science. Question authority, even, right? So this is not true in all circumstances, but this is a really good place to start, okay? And so this is a really, really old way of thinking about how proteins are made. Right, well, there's information in DNA, and where's that DNA located? In our cells? Inside the nucleus, right? And that DNA can be converted into RNA, and then that information in RNA can be used to make a protein. Right, and where did you find all of those ribosomes, in the nucleus or the cytoplasm? They were in the cytoplasm, right? Either on rough ER or free ribosomes in the cytoplasm. Okay, so when you look at this diagram right here, how many steps are there to making a protein? How many arrows do you see? I see two arrows. So there's two steps. We're going to have to learn the names of these two steps. What else can you tell me about these arrows? They're one direction, and both are pointing in the same direction, right? So information always flows from DNA into RNA, and the information in RNA flows into information in the protein, right? Which is how we would spell a protein out in terms of its amino acids. So information always flows from DNA into proteins and not the reverse direction. As far as we know, that's still true today. Proteins, okay, that information in a protein can't change your DNA. So when I go home tonight and have a chicken dinner, I don't have to worry about waking up with feathers and a beak, right? Because those proteins can't change who I am. Why? Because of these one-way arrows. Okay. We now know that sometimes RNA can be used to modify our chromosomes. Certain viruses can do that. All right, I'll talk about that in a little bit. But for now, let's just think about this. Where do you have DNA? Nucleus. Where do you have protein? Cytoplasm. And it takes two steps to make a protein. Okay. So DNA directs the production of proteins, not the reverse. So here are the two steps. The first step is called transcription. The second one is called translation. So this arrow right here, converting information in DNA into RNA, that is transcription. And translation is converting information RNA into a protein. So why do we name it these things? Who knows what transcription is? Yeah, you all know what it is. Okay, maybe you just don't have it on the tip of your tongue. But transcription is like making a photocopy of something, right? If you're applying for a job or another school to get in, they'll want to see what? A transcript, which is a photocopy of all that information which you have acquired, what passes you have taken, right? It's really an exact copy, okay? Different pieces of paper, but what about the information that's in administration and records and the transcript that you sent to somebody else? What can you tell me about that information? Exactly the same, okay? All right, so we call this transcription because, can anybody remember what the building block of DNA is? It's a deoxyribonucleotide, right? It's got a phosphate, it's got a ribose, or deoxyribose, what else? That's the sugar. Oh, and it's got a base on it, right? It's got those three components, right? So the building block of DNA is a deoxyribonucleic acid. And what's the building block of RNA? Yeah, just a plain old ribose, right? It's different by basically one oxygen atom, right? It's a ribonucleotide, not a deoxyribonucleotide. So the language of DNA and RNA is the same, right? There's just some very minor modifications to it, right? The alphabet is the same. The language is the same. And so we're just making another copy from information that's in the nucleus. And why that's important is because what happens when RNA gets inside the nucleus? Maybe it gets damaged, right? And then the rest of protein synthesis can't take place. But is the cell going to die if that RNA gets damaged? It won't, because what can happen? The information is still in DNA inside the nucleus, nice protected. It can make more RNA to replace that has been damaged or lost, right? So that's the job of transcription. It also carries that information, right, from the nucleus to where? Cytoplasm. So that might be another way of thinking of why transcription is important. But think of transcription as a photocopy, because the building blocks of DNA and RNA are the same language. Translation is when information in RNA is converted into information in a protein. Okay, what does translation mean? Yeah, can you translate? I bet a lot of you people can translate in here. What does that mean? Yeah, can hear information in one language and in your mind convert it into another language and speak that language so that who's ever listening to you gets the exact same information. Sounds totally different, right? The language is totally different, but translation is taking information from one language, converting it into another language. Like what? Farsi to Hindi would be a good example. Okay, Spanish to English, translation. Right, that's why the UN needs a lot of translators. Now, why do we call that translation? Because the building block of RNA is a ribonucleotide. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Two totally different languages, right? So that's why this is called translation. Okay. All right, so transcription occurs where DNA is, which is? Transcription takes place where? In the nucleus, right? Because that's where we always have DNA because it's nice and protected. All right, translation occurs in the cytoplasm, right? Because that's where these proteins are made. So there's two different locations, two different steps. All right, the linear sequence of nucleotides in DNA, right, it then makes messenger RNA, which is, again, just a certain sequence of nucleotides. And that sequence of nucleotides in RNA determines that sequence of amino acids that are put together to make a protein. Right, so that's why I like to think of the DNA as being the dictionary. It tells how to spell out a protein in terms of those amino acid languages or amino acid letters. Okay, so gene expression. That information is in DNA in something we call a gene. All right, so genes are just lengths of DNA that have information, or we could say code, for the synthesis of RNA. Right? What's that process called? And DNA is converted into RNA? Yeah, it's transcription, right? And so that messenger RNA then leaves the nucleus, combines with the ribosome, and then that ribosome can make a protein with the instructions that are carried by the messenger RNA. So sometimes people don't even say messenger RNA, we just say the message. So when somebody says the message is doing this or the message is doing that, you should think of what? Messenger RNA. Right? And that comes from transcription inside the nucleus. Okay. All right, so here's what your book has to say. Transcription, translation, two stages. Does one come before the other? Yep. What comes first? Transcription, right. Okay. Okay, so there are different kinds of RNA we're going to see in a little bit. In any case, we're going to call that transcription when it's made from DNA. That dark area inside the nucleus, we call the nucleolus. That's an active part that's making a kind of RNA that we call ribosomal RNA. Right, so that ribosomal RNA makes a ribosome. And of course, you saw how many you need. You need thousands and thousands inside of a cell. All right, so the genome refers to all the genes that we have in a cell. Okay, or you could think of inside your body, right? But just count one gene one time, so just think of one cell. And so that gene tells your body how to build a particular protein through what? Transcription and translation in those two different areas. So if you add all these genes up together, right, we call that the genome. That those are all the instructions to make the proteins inside your body. Right, so that's considered like a library. All right, in terms of nucleic acids. But we could also consider that same library, not in nucleic acids, but in proteins. What are all the proteins that can be made from these genes? Right, and we want to call that the proteome. So the proteome is similar to genome, but genome is? Yeah, it's DNA. Okay, proteome is proteins. Right, and of course, the DNA determines how these proteins are made. All right, so let's look at the structure of how a chromosome is put together. All right, and here I see two strands of nucleic acids. All right, if you see two strands, probably you could tell me what kind of nucleic acid that is. Is that DNA or RNA? Yeah. DNA is always double-stranded, right? And if we label some of these bases right here, of course you could tell me it's DNA. What base do you have in DNA that you don't have in RNA? You have in DNA. What do you have in DNA but not RNA? You've got thymine. Yeah. So you got to replace thymine in RNA. What is thymine replaced with? Uracil, right? Okay. And then those bases, okay, join up together according to those base pair rules. And you could think of this as a ladder or a spiral staircase. The sugar phosphate make the handrails. The bases make the steps of that ladder. Okay. Well, this is a super long molecule. And if we were to take all the nucleic acids in your body from all your cells, and I know you have a lot of cells, and string them from end to end, how long would that molecule be? We string out all of those, we've got 46 in one cell, string out all those 46, go to another cell, string out all those 46 end to end, and it would be 250,000 miles. And anybody have a good sense of how far that is? Probably you do. Well, sort of. It's the distance from the Earth to the Moon. That's really, really far. That's how much information is inside all of these cells. So, you can imagine that when that molecule is all strung out, it's very fragile. It can break, and indeed it does, okay? But it's packaged in a certain way. It's packaged with proteins. It's wrapped around proteins that act like a little bobbin, right? The protein is called histone, so I see one here and one here. And the chromatin, this is chromatin, okay, is wrapped around, and that forms what we call a nucleosome. Okay, then these nucleosomes are stacked up on top of each other, and then they're coiled, and then there's even some more coils. Right, so when the DNA is not being used, it's packaged in a very specific form that we call a chromosome, and we call this condensed chromatin. Right, when nucleic acids are condensed, they're nice and safe, they're protected from a lot of different things that might be happening inside the cell. When it's in an extended form, over here, it can be damaged pretty easily, but you know what? In order for transcription to take place, it has to be in an extended form. So that's why whenever chromatin extends, you only find it behind the nuclear envelope where it's protected. Okay. All right, so euchromatin is the part of chromosomes that are active in transcription. That's a little bit lighter in color. I like to also call that extended chromatin. Heterochromatin is a highly condensed region, and sometimes these genes are permanently deactivated, and they're really dark in color. And we have seen that these deactivated genes can be passed on from generation to generation. Genes are deactivated by our behaviors. So that's really kind of a strange concept, that how we live our lives can affect what kind of proteins our children can make. Okay? That's really interesting. That's kind of a new field. All right, so here we have chromatin. Right here I see nucleic acid wrapped around all these histone molecules. And so this is condensed. Yeah. Oh, let's go back. Yeah. There can be genes that are permanently deactivated. I don't have a good example on the tip of my tongue, but I'll look it up for the next lecture. Right? So you might do something, you might have a certain kind of diet that inactivates a gene because you no longer need it for whatever you're doing. And if that gene happens to be on a gamete, for instance, like an egg or sperm, then that deactivated gene gets transferred to your offspring. And then your offspring won't be able to make that particular kind of protein. And if they lose that structure, they might lose some kind of function as well. So, yeah.
Okay, so I kind of
what you're saying, but so if those are your
egg or whatever,
yeah. They we are now learning that they get the deactivated gene. Yeah. There's a question up over here. Yeah, what good is it doing us? And we have to really ponder that. Yeah, that's another way that there's a very strong interaction between environment and your genetic material, right? And so your environment can really direct what happens to your genetic material, you know, via your behaviors or whatever you're eating, things like that. Okay. Yeah, so euchromatin is extended, can be used for transcription, which means what? First step in protein synthesis. Heterochromatin has been permanently deactivated and is very dense in color, but there can be another kind of chromatin that I call condensed, right? And it's dark in color, but it's not permanently deactivated. It's just been wrapped up on all those histones so that it's protected, right? So extended and condensed chromatin. So how does that happen? All right, so all of this chromatin right here is wrapped up on these nucleosomes. That information cannot be used by the cell for transcription. So if the cell needs to get at a gene, it has to unwind all of these spools right here. And the way that that happens is that a part of this complex is acetylated. And acetylation, or acetate, is just a two-carbon molecule. And you're going to become familiar with that one, really familiar with that one, when we get into cellular respiration. So it's a very common molecule that's around in your body, right? So it's available. Enzymes can grab it very easily, right? Add it to chromatin, and it will go from a condensed form to an extended form. When it's in an extended form, then these genes, right, are revealed, and they can be used to make a protein. Right, so when chromatin is acetylated, when there's an acetyl group on there, it becomes an extended form. So here is one region, and so we're going to call this a gene because it can be transcribed. Right? Besides acetylation, there are usually other kinds of factors that have to be inside the nucleus that act as a transcription factor. These things bind to the very beginning, like the head group of a gene, and when it binds, that's what allows transcription to take place. Ooh, what's transcription again? What does it do? Converts information in DNA to RNA, right? So that transcription factor allows RNA to be made from this particular gene. And when your body no longer needs, right, that protein anymore, it wants to stop protein synthesis. A good way to do that is stop transcription. And that these molecules then are deacetylated. Those two carbon fragments are chewed off. And when that happens, like a spring, it just kind of coils back together. And those genes are no longer available for transcription. So acetylation is one way to activate or inactivate genes. And not all the genes in your body should be active at one time. All right, we used to think that one gene codes for one protein. We could call that a polypeptide chain, right? And each gene is several thousand nucleotides long, right? But the important thing on this slide is we used to think that the genome was exactly the same size as the proteome, that for every protein that your cell builds, there had to be a gene for it. Well, that's really some old thinking. We now know that that's really not necessarily true, and we're going to get to that in a second. All right, so what about transcription or RNA synthesis? That's another way. So an enzyme that can take building blocks and put them together, right, like a ribonucleic acid, different kinds of ribonucleic acid, so it's one nucleic acid after another, after another, after another. We call that a polymerase because all those nucleic acids joined together is a polymer. And this kind of polymerase makes what? What does this polymerase make? It makes a big, long polymer. And in particular, would you say protein? Would you say DNA? Would you say glycogen? Or maybe you would want to say RNA? Okay. Well, here's the name. RNA polymerase means that here's an enzyme that can take a sequence of nucleotides in DNA and make a sequence of nucleotides in RNA. So RNA polymerase actually makes RNA molecules. And of course that has to be inside the nucleus. All right, so what does this RNA polymerase do? It binds to that region that can bind a transcription factor. We call that the promoter region. If that transcription factor isn't available, then this is an inactive promoter region on the gene, and RNA polymerase can't start transcription. All right, so all things are good, or go, RNA binds to a DNA molecule. And what can you tell me? What's the usual form of DNA? Single-stranded or double-stranded? Double-stranded. So we need to get at those bases that are poking on the inside of the molecule, so the DNA molecule has to unzip so that we can see the sequence of bases or nucleotides that make up that DNA molecule. All right, so there's like an unzipperase property for this polymerase. So anytime you see an ASE, you should just realize that this is nice nomenclature saying that this is an enzyme. It's speeding up some kind of chemical reaction. And the chemical reaction is to build a polymer. Right. And is that a pretty easy job to do? Is it easy to unzip a DNA molecule and then maybe zip it back together? What are the bonds that hold the two strands together? Are they weak bonds or strong bonds? What kind of bonds are they? Okay, remember they're hydrogen bonds, and how strong is a hydrogen bond? Pretty weak. So it's easy to unzip a DNA molecule, to get at the sequence of bases, and then zip it back up when you're done with it, okay? Because of just those hydrogen bonds. All right, so here we have, I see a double helix right here. What does this have to be? DNA. But also I see thymine, which means this has to be DNA, right? So it's double-stranded. All right, so a DNA polymerase will unzip the DNA molecule, and then it will start to move down, one of the strands of the DNA, and it's going to base pair ribonucleotides to the deoxyribonucleotides that's making up this strand of DNA. Right, and it's really important that this DNA never breaks someplace in the middle, because if it breaks someplace in the middle, that's going to change the structure of the gene. Okay, and then the RNA won't be made in the right way. Right, when the RNA polymerase gets to a certain sequence of nucleotides at the stop signal, then transcription stops, it releases from the DNA molecule, and it also releases this part of RNA that's made. Okay, and this kind of RNA could be messenger RNA, could be ribosomal RNA, could be transfer RNA. And you notice, how many strands are used to make this RNA molecule? How many strands are there in DNA? There's two. And how many of those two strands are being transcribed at this particular slide? Yeah, there's only one. Right? That's what we call the sense strand. Right? And then here's the antisense strand. So RNA comes from only one side. Okay, and you can see that in RNA, there are never thymines, there are uracils right here. Okay, so what are the kinds of RNA? Well, you got that messenger RNA. That is the information on how to put amino acids together, basically how to spell out a word. And you have transfer RNA. It says decodes information that's contained in messenger RNA, but it does something else that I like to think about, and that is, in order for a ribosome to make a protein, what kind of building blocks does it need? What does it need? To make a protein, it needs, what's a building block of protein? Amino acids, right? So this transfer RNA is floating around in the cytoplasm. When it sees a particular kind of amino acid, it grabs it, brings it to the ribosome so that it can be put into a protein at that proper location, right? So you could think of transfer RNA as like being a taxi RNA, right? Taxi. Transfer RNA. Its job is to bring amino acids to a ribosome for translation, right? And then ribosomal RNA, that's pretty easy, right? We saw the two subunits, that was made out of ribosomal RNA. And that kind of RNA is made in the nucleolus. All right, one thing I skipped, and we got to go back to it, right? In our cells, messenger RNA usually is not made directly from transcription, but something that is called pre-messenger RNA. This is what's transcribed, and it's a precursor to what a functional messenger RNA is going to be inside the cytoplasm. Right? Pre-messenger RNA is modified within the nucleus to form some kind of proper, right, or competent messenger RNA. So pre-mRNA can't make a protein, but messenger RNA can. So let's look at a process. So what do we have right here? I see two strands. DNA, right? Genes are in DNA, and transcription will make what? A single strand or a double-stranded molecule? Single, because transcription goes from DNA to RNA. And this big long filament right here is what we call pre-messenger RNA. And is it homogeneous? Do you see one color through this whole big long strand? No, I see a couple of different colors. That means there's two different areas. Right? This pre-messenger RNA came from one gene, but it's got different areas. There's a dark area similar to this one here. Okay. And then there's light areas. These light areas are what we call exons. These dark areas we call introns. And what can happen inside the nucleus is that the messenger RNA could be cut here and cut here, and then maybe these two ends are joined, right? And then that's going to make one kind of protein, right? Or maybe this intron and this intron are going to be removed, and then these three segments of exons will be joined together. That's going to make a different kind of protein, all from just that one single gene. And so now we know that the genome, okay, is smaller than the proteome. The proteome is larger than the genome. One gene can make numerous kinds of proteins. And what we use to explain that is splicing, okay, alternative splicing. So one gene can produce one pre-messenger RNA, and that pre-messenger RNA can build different kinds of proteins depending on what exons are put together in what order. So that's pretty fancy. So the human genome only has 25,000 genes, right? Yet it can produce over 100,000 different kinds of proteins, and that's because of alternative splicing, splicing together exons inside the nucleus. Right? So in general, one gene doesn't code for one protein, it codes for three different kinds of proteins. And that's why the proteome is larger than the genome. Okay, so we're going to start here. Protein synthesis, the part that's in the cytoplasm. What do we call the part that's in the cytoplasm? The part of protein synthesis that's in the cytoplasm. That is translation. Yeah, that's translation. All right, so here I see a messenger RNA molecule. I see a bunch of ribosomes attached to it, and it's making these proteins. And I can see these individual amino acids that are coming together. And in lab today, you get to actually draw out what those bonds look like between amino acids, okay? Or on Thursday, whenever your lab is. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Okay, so now it's less than 1 week before your first exam. But I hope you thought that was helpful for you. No pressure.